Limbaugh said that it's not been proven that nicotine is addictive or that cigarettes cause emphysema. Now, who in the world would believe that nowadays?
One of the main areas of contamination in cigarettes is the solvents utilized to drive the flavoring chemicals and the aroma chemicals and the smoker satisfaction chemicals into the cellulose of the synthetic smoking material. They have to carry those chemicals into this alpha cellulose, which is recycled municipal waste, recycled forest industry product waste, that kind of stuff. They use things like benzene, toluene, and cyclohexane. They also use one of the more common solvents, and I have copies of the patents for the utilization of this, is phosgene.
That's nerve gas.
I was late to work. Honey, the traffic was horrible. I've had a headache all day. I mean, Jesus, give me a break.
Would you to eat breakfast, dear?
Well, no, I didn't have time for breakfast. I was late for work.
Each time you have to eat breakfast, and you don't have a whole day. I mean, you have a headache.
Everybody at the office was weird, you know? I mean, everybody.
Honey, I got the Valium. Would you like some?
Oh, I'd love one. Maybe that'll
just take a little Valium. I can feel a little less
prosper like Republicans. Paste this slogan in your hat. To live like a Republican, you must vote Democrat.
A potpourri of special reports and news, ranging from Rush Limbaugh, Haiti, Esther's Follies, and the 1952 election. Right now on Alternative Views. This Alternative Views features a potpourri of various subjects. We'll take a close look at Rush Limbaugh and all the lies that he's been spewing for lo these many years. We also will visit those special wacky satirists of Austin's Esther's Follies. They're always fun. The 1952 election we'll revisit, and our first news story is about Haiti.
There are a couple of aspects of the Haiti invasion, well, maybe more than a couple, which the media aren't giving you and the government, the U.S. government's trying to keep you from finding out. One is the basic policy which has parallels in U.S. policy toward other third world countries. And there's always been a policy of doing two things in the third world country. One is to develop local elites and work through them, give them part of the pie, enrich them so that they can help control the country. And then secondly, to train, equip the military and the police forces, teach them how to torture, teach them how to kill, so that they'll be able to keep the local populace under control. And then this, of course, will make it for a stable environment for the multinational corporations to come in and reap the benefits from the low wages and the stability which has been created. So this is what we see in Haiti going on, where the United States doesn't want Aristide to get in because Aristide wants to bring democratic participation to the people and more economic benefits from the people. This means that the corporations and the local elites would not have, perhaps, the stable and easily exploited labor force where people make 14 cents an hour.
Robert Perry, in the September 19th issue of In These Times, went into the whole history of the origins of U.S. involvement in Haiti, and it's not a pretty story. He tells the story of how Thomas Jefferson, the third president of the United States, led an effort along with Napoleon Bonaparte to crush Haiti's slave rebellions after the French Revolution, and how U.S. policy toward Haiti generally worked against democracy in that island. It's interesting that Jefferson is William Clinton's top hero as president, and Jefferson played a tremendously pernicious role in crushing this slave rebellion in Haiti that was led by Haiti's revolutionary hero Toussaint Louverture against the rebellion that took place at that time. This feeds the Haitian distrust of Haiti to this day, that is, the role that the U.S. has played since the beginning in crushing Haitian democracy. Well, what happened was the Haitian slaves revolted against the French slave system after the French Revolution. They were inspired by the mottos of liberty, equality, equality, and fraternity, and a slave revolt overthrew the French system. Well, in 1801, Napoleon Bonaparte became the president of France and dreamed of rebuilding the French Empire, and one of his dreams was to reestablish French rule over Haiti, that was now a free and independent country, and also to establish a base in the United States by occupying New Orleans. Well, Jefferson had his own concerns about the slave rebellion in Haiti, which, by the way, is an Indian name that the slaves gave the island after the revolt, replacing the French name. Jefferson himself was a slave owner who had 180 slaves and worried about slave uprisings in the South and saw the necessity of crushing this revolt. So he sent very sympathetic messages to Napoleon saying the United States supported any French efforts to crush the slave rebellion to reestablish French rule on that island. Well, in 1801, Jefferson figured out that Napoleon had aspirations on the United States, that he'd planned to occupy New Orleans and use that as a base to colonize parts of America. So Jefferson cooled on Napoleon and no longer supported his Haitian policy, but Bonaparte already had his expedition in motion and crushed the slave rebellion and reestablished French rule there. He tricked the hero, the leader of the Haitian rebellion, Toussaint Louverture, to peacefully surrender, and then killed him, and this triggered off another slave rebellion in Haiti, fighting again to regain their independence that was successful. But from the very beginning, the Jefferson administration imposed a stiff economic embargo on the island that hurt its economic development and its effort at establishing a democratic society. Moreover, Jefferson, to the end, was a enemy of Haitian democracy, although he had a very bizarre fantasy before his death in which he proposed taking all of the black slaves from the United States, the children, and sending them to Haiti so that eventually there would be no more blacks in the United States, and solving the slave problem in the U.S. So that way, this is a somewhat racist fantasy of Jefferson. So it wasn't until 1862, during the American Civil War, that Abraham Lincoln finally extended diplomatic recognition to Haiti. But by that time, the dictatorial policies of Haiti, the division of the country between rich and poor, and the oppressive system that remains to this day had been firmly established. So the U.S. was a major player in sort of crushing the aspirations of Haitian democracy from the beginning.
The American interventions in the Haitian country occurred regularly and culminated in Woodrow Wilson, that great Democrat, when he invaded Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and the people in the cabinet of Wilson were very, very racist, and what resulted was just murder and reinstituting virtual slavery of the people, dismantling all democratic institutions, the constitutional institutions, and turned the country into a virtual U.S. plantation. They established the National Guard, which has continued to this day, just the same kind of policy they did in Nicaragua in establishing Somoza.
Major General Smedley Butler was the Commandant of the Marine Corps and had won 2 Medal of Honors from the Spanish-American War and World War I. Here's what he said in regard to the aspect of his military career in intervening in third world countries, particularly Central America. I spent 33 years and 4 months in active service as a member of our country's most agile military force, the Marine Corps. I served in all commissioned ranks from a second lieutenant to major general, and during that period I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer for capitalism.
The situation continued and on up through the days of FDR and that wonderful Camelot man Kennedy, who helped to back Baby Doc, or rather Big Doc, Francois Duvalier, Papa Doc. And then in 1971, Baby Doc took over, and things continued in the United States. The USAID said that they were wanting to turn Haiti into a Taiwan of the Caribbean. Well, but instead of anything good for the people, they did the U.S. funded projects that would set up assembly plants in the country and made sure that through the military might and police brutality that the labor would be quiet and so people could turn out the American products for 14 cents an hour. Huge profits for the U.S. corporations occurred. There's a very key element which is not being talked about in the media, but which was considerably talked about on Alternative Views a few years ago when we were talking about the war on crime and the no war on crime, in which so many dope operations were being run out of the White House, and Oliver North was involved in this, George Bush was involved in this. We've talked about Noriega as being a player in this, although a comparatively minor player. But Doug, you mentioned a few times that the Haitian military were also involved in this dope trade, much of the cocaine trade.
It's amazing how this just has disappeared from the media stories about how the Haitian military has been a major player previously, along with Noriega and the Colombians, in bringing cocaine into the United States. There's been allegations that I've seen on TV that Aristide is somehow responsible or involved in the drugs trade, but this seems like complete disinformation. But nothing that I've seen has indicated the extent to which the Haitian generals are involved in, and have been involved in, the drug trade for some years, whereas this was well documented in both the alternative and the mainstream press some years ago. The story just seems to have disappeared.
I guess if there's too much of this, it gets out. If they start talking about it, it'll bring up too many questions about what the United States involvement was, and this can open up the whole drug trade, the Iran-Contra, and George Bush, and Ronald Reagan, and Oliver North, and all that whole operation that was going on at that time.
In fact, there was even quite a few stories about how the Reagan and Bush folks were opposed to democracy being established in Haiti, and that the CIA helped overthrow Aristide. It's on the public record that as soon as the Haitian generals took over, the CIA released a report that indicated that Aristide was mentally unstable, that he had been involved in criminal activities, that he was a communist, that he was a dangerous fellow who was harmful to U.S. interests and the like. So there's some indication that the CIA was even involved in overthrowing Haitian democracy in the first place. But again, none of this has been investigated in the American media that has basically just focused on whether U.S. troops should or should not be in Haiti.
A soldier whose name was Lee fought in the U.S. infantry. He said, "Things were fine till I stepped on that mine. Now I only am 4'3". We switch our attention now on Alternative Views to Austin's satirical review group called Esther's Follies. And we're going to get a little trip through the great state of Texas.
Here, but I should have been to bed an hour ago. And
I am tested.
I have
commit adultery. Amen. I do not covet my neighbor's wife. Amen. I do not jerk off. Amen. I do not do anything. I am Texan.
One of the most virulent forces in American politics is Rush Limbaugh, who's had a three-hour radio show and now a nightly television program that attacks everything liberal and decent in the country and that advances an aggressively right-wing agenda. Moreover, Limbaugh claims that he's telling the truth. He's telling you like it is, and he's exposing the lies and the evasions of the liberal media. On his radio show, Limbaugh once said, "I do not lie on this program, and I do not make things up for the advancement of my cause. And if I find that I've been mistaken or am in error, then I proclaim it generally at the top of the beginning of a program as loudly as I can." Well, Fair Magazine has published a long series of exposés of Rush Limbaugh's reign of error that goes through page after page of the things that Limbaugh said and then exposes them as lies. So Frank and I are going to give you some of the things that Limbaugh has been lying about, gleaned from the Fair study.
Yeah, this is from the extra edition of July and August 1994. Be sure to see it if you find it somewhere and look at it, because it has, you can see the whole complete listing. For instance, here are some of the things that Limbaugh said. Don't let liberals deceive you into believing that a decade of sustained growth without inflation in America in the 80s resulted in a bigger gap between the haves and the have-nots. The figures compiled by the Congressional Budget Office dispel that myth. Well, the reality is the CBO figures don't show that at all. Its numbers for after-tax incomes show that in 1980, the richest fifth of our country had eight times the income of the poorest fifth. By 1989, the ratio was more than 20 to 1.
After the California earthquake of last year, the California contractor C.C. Myers completed repairs in 74 days earlier than had been analyzed in advance on the earthquake-damaged Santa Monica Freeway. And Limbaugh said there was one key element that made this happen, one key thing. The governor of California declared the freeway a disaster area, and by doing so eliminated the need for competitive bids. Government got the hell out of the way. Another show, Limbaugh said. They gave this guy, Myers, the job without having to go through the rigmarole of giving 25% of the job to minority-owned businesses and 25% to a woman, as if it was free enterprise, unrestrained, that made it possible to get this freeway repair done earlier than anticipated. Well, here's the reality of the situation. First of all, there was competitive bidding for the contract. Myers beat four other contractors for the job. Secondly, affirmative action rules were applied. At least 40% of the contracts went to minority or women-owned firms. And thirdly, far from getting out of the way, dozens of state employees were on the job 24 hours a day to get the repairs done, to get the problem solved. And then furthermore, the federal government picked up the tab for the whole job. So this was basically government in action and not so much private enterprise as Limbaugh would make you believe.
We'll have more of Russia's lies later on Alternative Views, but now we switch our focus to something very different. We're going to go back and take a look at the 1952 presidential election between Eisenhower and Stevenson. And what makes it so special is that we'll be looking at some of the little jingles which the Democrats used to have for radio commercials at that time.
To live like a Republican, then you must vote Democrat. You can like the general, but vote for Stevenson. To prosper like Republicans, paste the slogan in your hat. To live like a Republican, you must vote Democrat. I met a certain friend of mine who said I voted GOP. I voted twice for Dewey and my house is clear and free. So let's leave well enough alone, at least we know where we are at. To live like a Republican, let's vote Democrat.
The Democrats were very overconfident, it seemed to me, at that time, because they had not lost an election since the 1932 election of Roosevelt. Roosevelt had four terms, and Truman was the next one to come on. And so as you see these little jingles, these little promos, you can tell how rather smug and overconfident the Democrats were at that time.
Chick here or a moo cow there, just broken down farmland everywhere. And Farmer Mac doesn't want to go back to the days when there wasn't a moo or quack, to the days of 1931 when he didn't have bread when the day was done. Farmer Mac knows what to do, election day of 52. Gonna go out with everyone in the USA to vote for Adlai Stevenson to keep his farm this way. With a vote, vote here and a vote, vote there and a vote for Stevenson everywhere. For if it's good for Mac, you see, it's good for you and it's good for me. All America loves that farm. Vote Stevenson today.
There is a lot finally starting to be written about the religious right and the really vicious campaigns, particularly against the Reaganites and the Republican Party. They call themselves moderates, and they're scared to death because these religious right-wingers are really attacking them in very vicious ways. And the religious right is also taking over a lot of local elections. But there is a study done by a sociologist, David Rusin, of Hartford Seminary, who says that this big church-going generation may be a thing of the past. Says the baby boomers are showing signs of going to church less often, particularly after their children leave the nest. He said that no generation had more of an impact on American religion than these baby boomers, because there was a big 1950s, 1960s, there were a lot of people going to church from this generation, but they left the churches in large numbers in the 60s and 70s when they saw organized religion as irrelevant. But here's some figures on this. Just 30% of baby boomers born between 1946 and 1955 with children no longer at home reported going to church regularly in 1990. Now that's about a third less than the 53% of the older boomers with preteen children who reported attending church three times a month. So it means these hypocritical parents, they force religion on their kids and everybody goes to church, but then when the kids are out of the nest and gone, they say, "Ooh, wow, the kids are gone, let's don't go to church." They have shown that 45% of the older baby boomers with teenage children only reported being regularly church attenders in 1990. But then even a lot of those are not going to church, because they're finding that the baby booming parents, even with teenagers in the house, they are participating in religion much less. So the religion people are quite concerned that there is going to be a swing away from all of this religion that we've been saturated with, and maybe the right wing will become more and more isolated. The sociologist said it would seem to follow that when the kids leave home, that motivation for church involvement has also been lost. So That's good news for the people who are tired of all these religious nuts running around forcing their agenda on us.
Well, Frank, there's a new strategy of the religious right to engage in character assassination of Bill Clinton. And in an article by Robert Perry in the July 25th in These Times, he indicates how this bare-knuckle politics of the religious right and other right-wing groups against Clinton is a manifestation of the Richard Nixon legacy of dirty tricks that lives on in the right-wing machine that is attempting to cripple the Clinton presidency. You recall that Nixon had his enemies list and he had all these dirty tricks where he would engage in character assassination and rumor, innuendo, and lies against Democratic politicians and his critics and enemies. And this strategy was pretty much taken up by right-wing groups in the 1980s, such as Terry Dolan's National Conservative Political Action Committee, Reed Irvine's Accuracy in Media and Accuracy in Academia group that would slander any critics of the Republican Party that then ruled during the 1980s. And since Clinton got in 1992, there's been fierce character assassinations of him by people like Rush Limbaugh, Jerry Falwell, and members of the religious right who have been circulating videotapes that are trying to indicate that Clinton is responsible for the murder of his staff member who committed suicide, that he has this criminal background that is being covered over by the liberal press, that he is killing people or threatening people that are attempting to uncover the truth about the Whitewater investigation and the scandals in his business and political practices when he was governor of Iowa. And Jerry Falwell and these people are, and Rush Limbaugh, are circulating, as I said, both tapes and documents. Well, recently some of the lies, the slander of this campaign, have been exposed. There was a supposed mugging of a New Republic reporter, L.J. Davis, in Little Rock, who was investigating Clinton and Whitewater, and supposedly he was beat up and his notes were stolen by Clinton thugs who were trying to protect the president. Well, this story, which was also in the Wall Street Journal, turns out to be completely a myth. The New Republic reporter in question got drunk the night before that incident happened and passed out in his hotel room and later admitted that his notes were not stolen, that he had not been attacked and had his research stolen. Now, as for Whitewater, this is an issue that is basically used by the Republicans to try to destroy Clinton, but neither the Republicans who are pursuing this issue nor the Democrats that are attacking Clinton are really getting at the heart of what all this is about, which is the SNL crisis. During the 1980s, major political figures of both parties were involved up to their eyeballs in SNL scandals, and Clinton's Little Rock land investment and SNL business ventures were small potatoes compared to the big scandals that were taking place on a national scale, again involving both Republicans and Democrats. The Democratic House leader of the time, Jim Wright, was forced to resign because of his involvement in SNL scandals. The House Democratic whip, Tony Coelho, was forced to resign because of his involvement in these scandals. Six senators were involved in SNL scandals with Keating, the California crook who robbed the SNL's blind. And there was hundreds of billions of dollars worth of American taxpayers' money that went down the tubes in these SNL scandals. So Whitewater is just a small part of this. So if we really want to get at the roots of the political scandals, there shouldn't just be a Whitewater investigation. There should be SNL investigation. Phil Gramm, for instance, one of the Republicans going after Clinton the most fiercely in the Whitewater affair, himself was given a house in Maryland, or big loans to build a summer house, a beach house, by SNL entrepreneurs. Al D'Amato, another Republican going after Clinton, was also given all kinds of favors by SNL people. So the scandal is really that the SNL virus infected the entirety of the major political establishment, and then Clinton is just being the scapegoat for this.
There's anybody with any sense and any who's read much of anything at all will recognize Limbaugh for the liar and gas bag that he is. But of course he uses all of these various propaganda themes, which, and then he weaves them around here and there, and so it doesn't make any difference whether he tells the truth or not. Truth is irrelevant. It's just the effect that he's after. Here's an example of what I can't imagine anybody in the listening to Rush Limbaugh would believe this one. Nonetheless, he said, "Do you know we have more acreage of forest land in the United States today than we did at the time the Constitution was written?" Well, in what are now the 50 U.S. states, according to Fair Magazine, there were 850 million acres of forest land in the late 1700s. 850 million. Only 730 million today. Now, Limbaugh's claim also ignores the fact that many of today's forests are single species forests, which have been planted by the companies, as opposed to the old natural growth forest, which had a variety and diverse ecosystem.
Limbaugh claims that most Canadian physicians, for themselves in need of surgery, scurry across the border to get it done right, the American way. They have found through experience that state medical care is too expensive, too slow, and inefficient, and most important, it doesn't provide adequate health care for most people. Well, the reality of the situation is that Limbaugh's claim simply isn't true. According to Dr. Hugh Scully, the chair of the Canadian Medical Association's Council on Healing and Financing, the vast majority of Canadians, including physicians, receive their health care right here in Canada. Those few Canadians who receive health care in the U.S. most likely do so because they have winter homes in the states like Arizona and Florida and have emergent health problems there. Medical care in Canada, he says, is hardly too expensive. It's provided free and covered by taxes. So once again, Limbaugh is full of it.
We switch from Limbaugh's inadvertent self-satire to the real thing of Esther's Follies and William Dente's Dame Della Diva. In another commercial from the 1952 election between Stevenson and Eisenhower, there was one in which they referred to Dirksen, McCarthy, and Taft in a song. You need words to a song, but for those of you who weren't alive at the time, you need to know who these people are. Taft, of course, was the Taft who was the isolationist and very conservative and against World War II. Dirksen was the senator who was the leader in the Senate, the opposition to the Democrats, and he was very conservative himself, very conservative. And then McCarthy, of course, was the McCarthy of the McCarthy era. So you had these three arch conservatives that were being talked about on this recording. And the Democrats were trying to paint the Republicans with this really vicious right-wing Republican brush, and trying to pin all of those ills, which were not popular in the country at the time, onto Eisenhower. So that was Dirksen, McCarthy, and Taft.
Dirksen, McCarthy, and Taft, would you pardon me if I laugh? There's no sense in pointing out one single case.
They simply are anti the whole human race.
Dirksen, McCarthy, and Taft, to follow them you would be daft. Put these men in power and you will regret. I guess you saw Dirksen on your TV set.
That look he gave Dewey is what we would get
from Dirksen, McCarthy, and Taft. Ha ha!
One of the disgusting things about Rush Limbaugh is how the liberal and conservative media basically accept him as one of theirs. He's often called on panel shows as an expert on this or that issue. He's been on the Charlie Rose show, on Meet the Press. He has laudatory articles written about him in the New York Times and Newsweek. U.S. News and World Report indicated in an article by Stephen Roberts that the information Limbaugh provides is generally accurate. Ted Koppel had him on a Nightline on an environmental show with Al Gore, where Limbaugh said, if you listen to what Senator Gore said, it is man-made products which are causing the ozone depletion, yet Mount Pinatubo has put 570 times the amount of chlorine into the atmosphere in one eruption than all of the man-made chlorofluorocarbons in one year. Well, this is simply a lie. Science Magazine indicated that the chlorine from natural sources, such as the type that Mount Pinatubo or other volcanoes shoots up into the air, gets rained out, that it's a soluble atmospheric pollution that doesn't go into the higher ozone, whereas the American or the products from industry, that the CFCs, are insoluble and inert and thus make it to the stratosphere to release their chlorine, and that there is an ozone problem. Every major scientist has said that ozone depletion is real, as certain as Neil Armstrong's landing on the moon. A Dr. Sherwood Rowland, an atmospheric chemist at the University of California, said, but yet over and over, Limbaugh repeats the same lies, that there's no danger from ozone depletion. And George Bush, by the way, followed Limbaugh in making fun of Senator Ozone, Al Gore, as if he was making up this ozone crisis.
Limbaugh said it's not been proven that nicotine is addictive or that cigarettes cause emphysema. Now, who in the world would believe that nowadays? Nicotine's addictiveness was reported in the medical literature since the turn of the century. And this information was highly suppressed in the mainstream media before and during, right after World War II. So the Surgeon General Everett Koop's report in 1988 left no doubt of the addiction of nicotine. And the Encyclopedia Britannica itself says that the scientific base linking smoking to a number of chronic diseases is overwhelming, with a total of 50,000 studies from dozens of countries. 50,000 studies compared to Rush Limbaugh's big old mouth.
In a previous Alternative Views program, Bill Drake told us all about the bad stuff in tobacco products.
What is it that they're addicted to? Is it the tobacco or these specific chemicals?
Well, there's a whole set of answers to your question, unfortunately, and I'll try to keep it short. For one thing, certainly they're addicted to nicotine. Nicotine is a component of cigarettes. Mostly nowadays, the nicotine that's in there is not in there as a result of being on a natural tobacco leaf. It's in there because the manufacturers have incorporated it as an ingredient in the synthetic smoking materials that most cigarettes are made out of now. Then, of course, there's a form of addiction that's generally not discussed with cigarettes, but it's a real factor, and that is that cigarettes contain so many extremely toxic ingredients that are put in there as a result of manufacturing decisions. They're not in any natural tobacco that may have somehow found its way into the cigarette. So there's a toxic addiction. When you take a small amount of a highly toxic substance into your body on a chronic, sublethal basis, your body develops an addiction to it. You stop ingesting that toxic chemical, and your body will go through withdrawal. It's not a withdrawal pleasure.
What are some of these things that they put in?
Well, for instance, one of the main areas of contamination in cigarettes is the solvents utilized to drive the flavoring chemicals and the aroma chemicals and the smoker satisfaction chemicals into the cellulose of the synthetic smoking material. They have to carry those chemicals into this alpha cellulose, which is recycled municipal waste, recycled forest industry product waste, that kind of stuff. It's basic cellulose. So they have to use solvents to carry these flavoring chemicals and so forth into the alpha cellulose. They use things like benzene, toluene, and cyclohexane. They also use one of the more common solvents, and I have copies of the patents for the utilization of this, is phosgene.
That's nerve gas.
That's exactly right. It's a very effective solvent as well. And residues of it remain in the alpha cellulose after processing is through. And so when the cigarette is smoked, when this synthetic smoking material is burned, in addition to the release of chemicals that naturally accompany the combustion of organic materials, you get release of such things as phosgene and benzene. And
well, now, benzene, solvents. That's a known carcinogen, too.
Precisely, yeah, exactly. One of the main reasons that the cigarette industry, and we need to distinguish between the cigarette industry and the tobacco industry, but one of the main reasons that they are able to say it's never been effectively proven or scientifically proven that cigarettes cause cancer or heart disease and so forth. Well, it actually hasn't ever been scientifically proven. And that's primarily because the cigarettes that are utilized by NIH and all the other testing organizations in conducting their rat skin painting tests and all that sort of thing are especially supplied to them by the tobacco industry. And they're University of Kentucky standard 100-millimeter cigarettes, and they are composed of pure tobacco. There's no synthetic smoking material. There's no benzene. There's none of the processing chemicals utilized in these cigarettes that are smoked by the machines and then painted on the mouse skins and so forth. So there's an elaborate set of reasons why the tobacco industry, or pardon me, the cigarette industry, is still, in the face of common sense, able to maintain this glib, disingenuous attitude of, well, nobody's really proved it.
Well, in fact, there's many different kinds of tobacco and even pesticide residues that get into cigarettes. It's not
exactly
the pure, sweet leaf that you sometimes see in the South, you know, hanging up to dry.
And you see in all the ads.
Right, and you see in all the ads. Tell us a little bit about junk tobacco and
you
the
bet.
Way that pesticide residues get into tobacco and add to the poison here.
Well, in addition to synthetic materials, synthetic smoking materials, mm-hmm. which today comprise a large portion of most brands of cigarettes, you have what's called reconstituted sheet, appropriately named. And it's composed of roots and stems and trash, tobacco trash, brought into this country by the cigarette manufacturers, primarily from third world sources, utilized. It's ground up into a fine powder, and it's incorporated along with glues and flavoring chemicals and so forth into a sheet that looks, it looks like a piece of plywood or a particle board, which is then shaved in giant mills. And that's, if a person who's smoking cares to, and a lot of people would rather not know, which is one of the reasons that perhaps sets are clicking at this very moment. But for those who are listening who care to, take a cigarette, cut it apart, and look at those little golden curls under magnification, and you'll see that they're not parts of leaves. There's no veins in them, you know. But what you can see is you can see they're composed of little fine particles. That's ground up roots and stems. Those tobacco plants in the third world where they were originally raised were sprayed with all kinds of pesticides. I have research that has been done in Europe that indicates that there are dozens of pesticides, many of which are totally banned in this country.
Like
DDT,
what?
Chlordane, heptchlor, toxaphene, dieldrin, aldrin, andrin, on and on. Endosulfan, a wide range of pesticides that have known fetus-damaging effects. They are chemicals that are specifically designed not to kill bugs, because bugs generally in the tropics now, you can't poison them. They're immune to poisons. So you have to go after them genetically. And these chemicals are designed either to go after the adult bugs to mess up their reproductive systems, or the third level of pesticides being used and getting onto tobacco and getting into the roots and stems and being brought in and made into remanufactured sheet in this country. There are even chemicals designed specifically to produce non-viable insect offspring.
And this works then, its magic through cigarettes and the people then?
We don't know. But I think it's really unlikely that all the damage to fetuses being experienced by smoking mothers is due to carbon monoxide and nicotine.
You think it's these chemicals as well?
Well, I think it's reasonable to assume that if you're ingesting six different chemicals and three of them are known fetus damagers and carcinogens, mm-hmm. and three others you don't know what they are, they may or may not be, I think it makes sense to focus on the things that you know are there.
Mm-hmm. Well, after all the bad stuff we've been talking about on Alternative Views, we might be just a little bit uptight, but not quite so much as Esther's Follies' uptight couple.
Well,
relax. Maybe we'll
good
go to bed and see what happens.
And that's Alternative Views for this time. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network. P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. We'd like to thank some of the people who've made our program possible. For our news sections, Eric Eubank was the camera person, and Kevin L. West did the audio. And for some of the other sections, Brian Lynch was our director. And Georgia Davis provided editing assistance. Alternative Views is a presentation of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. If you have any comments about the program, that's our address, and we'd love to hear from you. Goodbye.